Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sons of the Double Cheeseburger podcast. I am Kevin, and this is...
Brandon. Okay. Hey, how you doing? Sorry, I was
right.
messing
no.
around with the guitar, and I couldn't
no,
stop.
No, you know what? That's... that suits your Christian vocational background.
That's right.
Are you working on... maybe becoming a youth minister? Or
yeah, I'm thinking
a worship
about
leader?
Thinking about going back and becoming a worship leader. And so, yeah, I'm working on my power chords and my earnest face.
You know,
right now, honestly, I'm not real good at either of them.
This was really missing from your romantic repertoire when we were in college.
Yeah,
it would have been something to sit on the plaza and...
strum a guitar.
Strum some Michael W. Smith or Stephen Curtis Chapman or something. Maybe
I think it
would have
been Keith Green.
If
I had been doing Keith Green, that's what would have driven the missions majors
right,
nuts.
Exactly. Keith Green is if you're looking for a missions major, right? Rich Mullins is if you're looking for a... I don't know. Let's see. Because Rich Mullins was a little bit edgy, right? Right? I mean, for the context.
He was. So, Rich Mullins was very missions-oriented, but also, yeah, he was a little more edgy. He was a little, you know, he saw the dark underbelly.
Right. Stephen Curtis Chapman is if you were just looking for the mainstream.
Yeah. If you were just, you know, as someone who was just there for the standard MRS degree, then that's what you were doing. You were doing Stephen Curtis Chapman. It's going to be deeply offensive to anybody that we know who went to school with us, and I apologize.
Well, I mean, if any of this sounds sexist, it's because we're accurately describing a very sexist
that's
environment.
That's a good point.
Right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's embarrassing to have been a part of. But
it's true.
In any event, so
but if I can quote a movie that we weren't allowed to watch while we were at that extremely sexist institution, what's the matter with being sexy? So, yeah. Anyway, no, playing, trying to get a little bit better at the guitar is one of the things I've been messing around with. This year, I thought that would be, did I tell you, I don't think I told you about this. Like for years, I have told myself that I couldn't play the guitar. I tried. I took guitar lessons when I was, I don't know, junior high maybe, right?
I remember that, yeah.
And I took, for a very short time, and I didn't do very well. And the biggest problem was that I couldn't get my hands to do independent things.
Right.
So I gave up. Have I talked about this here?
No, but I can relate to that because that's my problem.
Yeah, so I couldn't get my hands to do the two things independently. I would strum and I could move my hands around, but I couldn't do them simultaneously. And so I gave up and I just said to myself, I can't do that. And played brass instruments from then on, where you only had to move one hand at a time. So that was my speed. And I told myself this for like, I don't know, like 30 years. And I'm not joking. I was like driving one day and I was thinking about that. And then I had this thought. I realized that I'm a really fast typist. I mean, I'm not super fast because I don't type that much anymore. But mm-hmm. when I was typing a lot, when I was in school and I was doing, I could type like 60, 70, 80 words a minute.
No way.
Yeah. With like no errors or very few errors. And I realized, well, wait a minute. Your hands are doing two completely independent things then. You're thinking the whole thing through and you're just... I was like, my hands can do two different things at the same time. So then, like, I rubbed my belly and patted myself on the top of my head for a while. And I confirmed that I could do two different things at the same time. And I decided to start trying at guitar again. So...
And are you finding with a different mindset that you're getting different results?
I am, yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, just having come at it and thinking, I can actually do this. And I just need to get myself in the rhythm of it. And the other thing that I'm doing is I've really committed myself to practicing regularly, which is a huge help because I will find that a lot of days I will look at the lesson that I'm doing for that day, and I will try it, and I will really not be able to do it, but I will practice it anyway, and I'll try it at the speed that I can do it at, and I will come back the next day, and I can do it more effectively. Sometimes I can do it on the second day at the speed I was trying to do it the first day.
Well, that's great. So you're saying practice helps.
It's doing it for me. Yeah. I mean, I'm doing like 20 or 30 minutes a day, and it's helping a lot. So, and I've just gotten back to the stage in the lesson thing that I'm using that is helping to think about some of the musical theory stuff, some of the, you know, thinking about scales and chords and all that stuff. And so, but I've been working. You know what I'm really bad at still is strumming up.
Mm.
The down up, I'm not good at the up. So I'm also not great at palm muting. So yeah, there are still a few learning curves. I'm not quite Jimi Hendrix yet.
I'll give you another couple weeks.
Yeah, we'll yeah. But see, the way I'm looking at it is now that I've said I'm not quite Jimi Hendrix yet, I'll play through his whole catalog tonight badly, and then I'm pretty sure by tomorrow I'll have it based on how this has been going. So I'll throw that in as a little bonus. I'll like throw in my version of Hey Joe. How's that sound?
Well, I think
at
we
the
now
end
know
of the episode. Everyone should listen for that.
We now know what we're going to talk about in the next episode is your miraculous guitar playing skills elevation.
Yeah.
That's a terrible sentence I just made.
That's okay. Yeah, I think I got to a point where like John Kasich, I found myself at a crossroads. And I made a deal with the devil. And now I'm playing guitar adequately, sort of. So, there you go. I've been doing that. What have you been up to?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this. I manage my son's Little League team.
I don't think we've talked about that here. I am familiar with that. But
team of 11 and 12-year-olds.
Yeah.
And the team I took over for it's the second year on this team. Mm-hmm. Took over for manager last year. The team last year was 0-15-1, which, for those who are not necessarily sports minded, that's bad.
Because the wins, the first number is wins, right?
Right.
In the
We had none of those wins.
Yeah.
We had 15 of the losses.
And then one
and
abstention.
One was that is correct. Yes. The other team refused to commit to playing better than us. So we ended up with what's called a tie, as you might
know. Oh, man. The old kissing your sister. Yeah. Okay. Got it.
Yes. Yes. Which is interesting because two players on the team last year had twin sisters. So I don't know if, know that either of them were actually kissing their sisters. But their sisters are also both in the same dance company, so this is very interesting as well.
There's a lot of cross-pollination going on here.
There is. So last year did not end successfully. And going to the playoffs is a double elimination tournament.
Okay.
Last year we were double eliminated in the swiftest possible fashion.
So you were successfully double eliminated.
We were.
That's good.
We did. We did that very well. We were quicker and more efficient at that than anybody else.
Nice.
In the league.
That's something to build on.
Yeah. And so last year, but I mean, it worked out okay. Last year, our consolation prize, we lost our second playoff game. We were mm-hmm. eliminated. And so the next morning, my family and I went to Hawaii.
There you go.
So
that's pretty
good. I
assume
that was our reward. I don't know. I don't know how else we ended up there. But
that's... That was on my credit card, right? You did.
A little bit on everybody's
card. A strange bill that showed up that I didn't anticipate. All right. Well, bully for all of you.
So this year, I took over the team. The the woman who had been managing the team. I had coached, and the woman that managed it, her son, moved up to the next level.
Oh, I thought she was fired. She was not fired. It's good.
There were unhappy parents. There were lots. It was crazy. How had the season ended? Mm-hmm. It was not pleasant. I felt bad for her because people were being unpleasant with her and such. So, there are some people that left the team and put themselves back into, being put on a different team and whatnot. Anyway, so we only had 4 returning players. And we weren't even sure we were going to play this year because of the virus situation.
Yeah.
And that was in around the time that our family went on vacation. I'd committed to managing the team.
Okay.
But there was nothing happening. And we said, well, we're going on vacation. And we were told, no, nothing will happen in that time at this point. And we get on vacation. And about halfway through our vacation, we hear, all right, league starting up. Draft is tomorrow or whatever. And I was like, ha, 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 ha. I'm not there.
Oof.
So I didn't. I wasn't able to be at the draft, and I needed 8 players.
Yeah.
So the manager of one of the other teams in the league drafted for me.
Okay.
So that seems on the up and up, right?
Oof. Boy, this sounds like early, like late 1900 or late 1800s Major League Baseball.
Yeah. So it was. Right, the season before, we were the Cleveland Spiders.
Yeah.
Right? So I ended up with a kind of a crew of guys, nice kids, good young gentlemen. But, we had this draft list where players were ranked.
Mm-hmm.
And, several of my players weren't even on the draft list. Several of them didn't have a ranking because nobody knew anything about them.
Wow.
It's how did I end up with so many players that were a complete shot in the dark?
That's just dumb luck.
Seems. Anyway. So we were,
Is there any chance that other coach is going to listen to this?
Probably not.
Okay.
Probably not.
Because it sounds that guy maybe did not draft in good faith. I'm just
saying. Well, I don't know that a lot of things are in good faith in this league.
Yeah.
So it's fine. I like the group of guys I got. And we went out. We won our first game.
Yeah.
And then we tied our next game.
Okay.
And then we lost many games.
Was it by many? Was it the rest?
We lost 5.
Oh, okay.
And then we won one. We lost a couple more. And then we won our last 2,
which was nice.
We finished 4-7-1. We only played 12 games this year because of the virus.
Yeah.
So 4-7-1, I felt like was a significant improvement, really, over the year before. A team of guys, some who hadn't even played ball the year before, guys that hadn't played together, because many of the other teams have the advantage of half their team. They kind of try and work it out that you've got usually 6 12-year-olds and 6 11-year-olds.
Yeah.
And so you always have kind of a core group of guys that have played together. And so you could have a chance to get better. We didn't have as much of that. But 4-7-1 I thought was an improvement. We did not finish in last place.
Nice.
There were 5 teams in the league. We finished in 4th. And we really just finished half a game or a game behind the team in front of us. They had the same number of wins as us, but they had 2 more ties. They had many sisters to kiss. So I thought we were real close. I thought we, shown some real improvement. And
so they came ahead of you in the standings, but they should have felt dirty about it.
Yeah, I would say that.
Yeah.
Among other things, sure. And then so... we won our first playoff game last night, and today we played the top seed in the tournament, a team that had gone 10-0-2 in the regular season. Lots of ties this year, which was unusual for me. But
now, do you get a tie if you get to the end of the 6 innings and you're done, or it is
no? There's a time limit.
Okay.
So it's 7 innings. As long as you can get those 7 innings in within 2 hours.
Oh, like the major leagues.
It's like a mixture of baseball and every other sport.
Yes.
Right? Except, I guess, tennis. Bully for tennis, it does not have a time limit. I like the fact there's not a time limit to baseball. But I can understand when you've got kids and it's, you know, it's going to be 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
You want to, you know, you got to at some point.
They got to get home to they're not going to school tomorrow.
Well, I mean, now maybe the kids are doing some school events, right? But yeah, before that, right, there was no school.
Yeah.
But also, you know, after 2 hours, a lot of these kids are not still engaged.
No.
If you know what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. No.
So, I'm not a big, I don't have any real problem with there being a 2 hour limit.
This is also true of the Pittsburgh Pirates, by the way.
Right.
Yeah.
Many kids there, too. But in the playoffs, then, there is no time limit.
Okay.
I'm not sure. That's the part, one part that doesn't make sense to me. Why do we start playing by a different set of rules in the playoffs?
Because Rob Manfred is your commissioner?
Yeah, I mean, no kidding. Which really just serves to favor the teams that have more pitching.
Sure.
Because probably the average game goes 5 innings.
Okay.
Okay. Which means that I only have to come up with 5 innings of pitching.
Yeah.
And there's limits, there's in terms of the number of innings you can pitch in a game and in a week,
mm-hmm.
because these are young, tender arms, and we don't want to ruin them. But you get to the playoffs, and we're playing, you know, potentially 6 games in an 8-game span, but I can still only throw one particular pitcher 4 innings in a game, 7 innings in a week.
Yeah.
Well, I've only got really one frontline pitcher and then some, you know, second tier and third tier guys.
Sure.
But there's other teams that have, you know, 3 frontline pitchers.
Yeah.
So there's a little element to that, which... I mean, and I don't, you know, I guess I don't see a way you do it differently, because it's not like you can say, well, for this week, we're not going to care about this young man's arm. Well, of course, you still have to do the right thing, so. But, yeah. It's, you know, what can you do? So we lost tonight through the first 3.5 innings, through the middle of 3 innings, 4 innings.
Mm-hmm.
We were tied up with them. And that had actually been, we had given them a couple of opportunities that we really shouldn't have. We should have been in an even better position. But then we gave up 8 runs in the bottom of the fourth, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those innings where a few bad calls, a few miscues, and suddenly you're 8 runs deep.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well... congratulations to your team on getting that first playoff win, which means you get to play 3 playoff games because it's a double elimination, you said, right?
That's right, yeah. We play again on Tuesday night against the loser of... there was a game earlier today, and the team we beat.
Nice. So
we'll see how that goes.
Now, are all of your teams living now in a bubble?
No, we have not been in a bubble at all.
Okay.
In fact, a lot of these boys really seem a lot more kind of touchy and hands-on than I remember being as an 11 or 12-year-old.
Hmm.
Just right up on top of each other. So, of course, the rules say we can only, there has to be space.
Yeah.
We can only actually have 4 boys in the dugout because of the amount of space that leaves. And then they're supposed to space out, well, they space out all the time, supposed to space themselves out down the fence on the, you know, down the outfield line. That does not happen as much. I'm fighting them. They're supposed to wear masks when they're not in the field. That has been a difficult battle to fight.
So this season, it's really been like the dual role of being manager and compliance officer.
Yeah, and babysitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's been tough, but, you know, it's been fun. It's been good to have some baseball.
That is fun. Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Well, good luck for tomorrow's game.
Well, thank you.
And if you win that game, then you get to go, you go on, presumably at that point, maybe it's at like the championship game level. Is that right?
No, then we will play the loser of the game between the team that beat us today and the team that won their game earlier today.
Okay.
So one of those teams, those two teams are going to play, and one of them will get their first loss.
Oh, I see.
We will play that team, and that would theoretically be the championship game.
Okay.
Now, if the one team just comes straight through the winner's bracket and doesn't have any losses, even if we were to beat them then at that stage, we have to play another, to play them again in order to double eliminate them.
Yeah, right. Well, Kevin and I had a little bit of an audio glitch that happened at this point in the podcast, and so we lost his audio for a few minutes. So this is where we're going to stop. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to jump back into things. Yeah, computers, huh? They're fun.
The future, my friend.
The future. The future is now, and it keeps breaking down.
The future, now on computers.
Now on computers. Pretty exciting stuff. So, hey, okay, so we talked about me trying to play the guitar. We talked about you being a burgeoning manager for the boys' sports team. Playing the sports ball, which is good. And are you gonna continue to be a manager, like in general, like Matt? Are you gonna have him play the football so you can be the manager of that team?
No. I will not be taking on managing in any other sport.
Okay. Would you like to be my band manager?
I'm not sure I have the skill set to be a baseball manager.
Okay.
So maybe I have the skill set to be a band manager, but I don't know that that's true.
Have you seen Flight of the Conchords?
I've seen occasional episodes.
Because I could use a manager in the style of Murray. So if you can be that kind of manager, I'm ready.
I'm going to look into that.
Yeah, I think you can pull it off. All right. So I was going to... The reality is we wanted to get together. We wanted to talk tonight catch up and get a few of these things out there. I didn't have any big topics to talk about. Again, it's weird times, you know. We're continuing to see all kinds of unrest that happens everywhere. We've had both presidential conventions now, and those were something. Are you aware of Jim Gaffigan full on losing his mind on Twitter?
I am. Yeah, I was thinking of bringing that up.
Yeah.
When you manage to make, you know, a guy that is known for being
a clean comic,
you know, affably self-effacing.
Yeah.
And you've gotten him to swear, you know, quite heavily.
Yeah.
At you and offer imprecations and. It's really, yeah, I like what he had to say to Lou Holtz. That was...
I did. I like that. Did you happen to see that his wife, Jeannie, responded to that and said something like that she agreed with him, but the swearing was unnecessary?
And then I think he was just like, okay, fine.
Okay,
and
fine.
And then he swore some more.
Yes.
So he seemed upset.
I think he was very upset. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think things are getting better before they get worse, because I think we have a country that increasingly has got a couple of sides who see the other in extreme terms, and there's going to be an election, and whoever wins, the other side is going to be extremely dissatisfied by that.
Yeah, well, and I think there's at least, if we're looking at the two campaigns, I think there's a very deliberate attempt to make things worse with the one.
Yeah.
I agree with your idea that there's a significant element of seeing the other as the extreme and as, you know, kind of the death of democracy. But I'm not sure. I think that only comes from one of the campaigns officially.
Yes. Although I do think both, I mean, I agree with you. I think only I think one of the campaigns is painting this in terms like, you know, that candidate, well, let's just say who it is, that Joe Biden is going to destroy America, right?
Right, Joe Biden, famously centrist Joe Biden.
Famously centrist, you know, left-wing Maoist Joe Biden is going to destroy America. I don't think that the Democrats are necessarily saying that, but they are saying pretty extremely, you must get out. We have to take this back.
Right.
I think,
to be fair, both sides are the Democratic Party is indicating that indeed this could be the death of democracy.
Yeah.
But they're not, I think there's a stronger effort to justify that position by pointing at the policies and actions,
yes,
and you know telegraphed plans, mm-hmm, of the current administration.
Right. I would agree. I think the Democrats are saying we're concerned that this could be the end of democracy, and our basis for that is what you're seeing happening in our country right now. And then the Republicans are saying that they believe that Joe Biden will be the end of the democracy. And strangely enough, they're also basing that on what's happening right now. They're saying, look at what's happening right now. If you elect Joe Biden, this is what's going to happen.
But it's already happening.
But it's happening now. And that's
look at what a mess everything is.
Right.
Vote for us and we'll make it better.
Yeah. I made everything better, but now look at what a mess everything is. You need to elect me again so I can fix this.
Yeah, running on change as an incumbent is probably a first in, at least in American politics.
I think so. So that's probably going to be fodder for conversation continuing going forward, but...
Are you feeling Gaffigan-esque in the sense that you feel like you no longer have, you know, the idea that maybe politics is something that we don't discuss? Do you feel like it's become an imperative to discuss politics, regardless of what your position would have been otherwise?
Yeah. Previously? Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, I think because our political landscape is becoming so fraught that to not mention it at all just seems like you're just blindfolding yourself. You know what I mean?
I do. And I, you know, perhaps...
In the same way that we haven't been able to get away from talking about, like, COVID, right? I think we even started this whole thing being like, this is going to be something of an antidote to... having to think about all the COVID stuff, all the shelter in place stuff. But eventually it's like, it's so continuous. It's so immersive that everybody's conversations end up coming back to it again. And politics have always been a huge topic for people, but I think that they have become so alarming and such a wide gap that I think it's becoming hard to not, you know, if they're not in a conversation, you're probably sitting like fearing, oh crap, is it going to come up in this conversation?
Well, and the reality is it probably should be in the conversation.
Yeah.
I guess some would be, I mean, based on things we've already said, or on what I'm going to say, people could accuse us of having a bias.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one, I think, you know, saying that someone has a bias in their political beliefs is kind of a foolish accusation to throw. Because if you don't have a bias, if you don't have a platform that you support based upon, you know, beliefs that you have, then what are you doing? What right. are you, you know, how are you making your decisions on who you do or don't vote for?
Right.
So I don't know that having a bias is probably appropriate, but
well, I think people misuse the word bias. I mean, again, that's missing the point that to have a stated opinion is not to have a bias. It is right. to have arrived at a position.
You had this conversation with someone on the social media.
Sure did. That's called having a worldview. Having a bias is when you look at things that are not directly connected to that, or you look at something and you immediately load it with, before you've made an assessment, you start with all of these preconditions.
Right.
That's bias.
Yeah. I think there's already, and this is, I'm bothered by the fact that there is an equivalency drawn between the two positions. That, well, the current administration is saying that this is potentially the end of America and the end of Christianity and the end of everything we understand and know.
Yeah.
If the the Democratic candidate is elected, and the Democratic Party candidate putting forth the idea that these are the things we're seeing that are disturbing to us. This is what these would appear to naturally be leading to based upon what's happened, the progression that's already taken place, and based upon the telegraphed intentions. To say that the two sides are, that there's an equivalency there between, the arguments, to me is incredibly offensive.
Right.
And yet that is how it is still being presented in terms of the media that people are seeing. If people are seeing anything other than what is already, and I think I'm using the word correctly here, a biased media.
Yeah.
The idea that there is a left-wing media is one of the most successful lies that the American right has perpetuated.
Well, I'm probably not disagreeing with you, but let's say the idea that media is left wing unless it is explicitly counter to that,
right?
Because okay. I do think that, I mean, again, might as well name names here, right? Christy and I were talking about this pretty recently, that I think it's really telling that when our president calls out news networks and accuses them of being left wing and dangerous tools, I think it's really striking that he actually doesn't call out, as far as I've ever heard, he doesn't actually call out MSNBC as a network. Now, he will call out individual broadcasters on MSNBC, but he doesn't call out MSNBC as a network. And I think that part of the reason for that is that MSNBC knows where it is. MSNBC is left of center, unapologetically, mm-hmm. and they are keeping a close eye on him. Okay? If you are a regular consumer of MSNBC, you're not undecided in any, there's no chance really that you're undecided on the Donald Trump question. Okay?
Right. It's entirely fair to say that MSNBC is the left equivalent of Fox News.
I mean, I'm not sure that there is tawdry with the truth.
I'm going to let you finish what you were saying.
But say for example CNN. Like, he will take a lot of shots at CNN. When CNN is criticizing him for something, he will go after CNN. And he will do that because CNN, I think, is more centrist than MSNBC is. And you notice that when some Fox analysts were questioning him for some of the most reprehensible things he was doing, suddenly he wanted to talk about how Fox had these left-wing influences, right? Because he's talking at those points to people, the person who watches CNN or who watches Fox, those are people who either are voting for him or could be voting for him. So he wants to make sure they hear that the message they're being given is poisoned against him. Mm-hmm. Right? He doesn't bother doing that with the MSNBC as a network, because all of the people who are regular, you know, consumers of that network aren't buying what he's selling no matter what.
Right. Okay.
You're right. The idea, the argument that the media is leftist, is left wing, is really not terribly accurate. And in a time where frankly the media is more and more, and of all kinds, has to reckon with the fact that there are essentially citizen journalists out there all over the place, you have to be real intentional about shaping what you're doing to get away from the center, I think, in some ways. Because there's documentary evidence in a way that, like, 40 years ago, stuff could be happening in the streets, you know? Somebody was, I don't remember where it was, but somebody had put up a political cartoon from 1967 with Martin Luther King Jr. And it was talking about he wanted to continue having peaceful protests, and it was showing like there had been looting and there had been damage and stuff behind him. And they said, look, the playbook hasn't changed.
Right. Right? I posted that. Yeah.
But the problem is that 50 years ago, a media outlet could say that. This is what's happening in Birmingham. And we could get a little bit of video. We could get some pictures. But somebody living, say, like where I live in California, wasn't necessarily seeing the full extent of what was going on. People living in other parts of the country can see everything that is happening. And so it is much harder to sell that nonsense. You have to do misdirection. And so that's what the more biased outlets do, is they misdirect.
Well, and it's really, I think the misdirection is, they're so committed to the misdirection that it becomes just outright lies. Mm-hmm. I think at times it used to be that we will misdirect in terms of kind of bending what the truth looks like.
Right.
Now there isn't really, and this, I think, comes back to your point about journalism kind of having become anyone. Mm-hmm. Individuals do not necessarily have the same sort of organizational integrity.
Right.
Now, maybe some of the organizations don't have organizational integrity anymore either, but there are individuals who are so committed to a viewpoint that they don't see the idea of spreading untruths intentionally as being a negative, because that's in service of what they know is the truth, regardless of what evidence they see. And the trouble is now we have an administration that has no ability. Well, I mean, we have a populace that has lost much of its ability to discern truth from misdirection.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we have an administration that can't do that either. And it is happy to amplify, the reckless part is it's happy to amplify anything it hears that brings a joy in terms of seeming to be in support or reinforcing a position or viewpoint.
Right. Yeah, I'm.
That's the difference between winning, because politics has become about winning.
Yeah.
It's not about governing in a way that you think will allow everyone to win. It's about how can I personally win. Or me and my cohorts win.
Yes.
Winning doesn't mean that the country is run successfully. It doesn't mean that people are taken care of. It means that we get power. We get what we want.
Right. Yeah.
It sounded very strident there.
No.
I feel very strident because that is something that is the opposite of what political service should be.
Yeah. 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 And I don't. It becomes hard to not end up heading down the road. And frankly, you see people on both sides of the aisle doing this, who head down the road of just saying the whole thing is corrupt, right? That everyone is out for themselves. Everyone's got their hand in the till. It's just different tills. And this is honestly this is the point at which I become I become increasingly skeptical about whether democracy is going to survive in this country.
Right.
Because I think that the erosion of confidence in public servants has gone so far that again, you have one side who's been living in protest of what's been happening, and the other side who says that, you know, the apocalypse is coming if Joe Biden wins. Yeah, and I am genuinely tired of hearing Christian rhetoric from the Republican Party and from Republicans. It is utterly blasphemous. Mike Pence, for example, taking a passage of scripture that speaks specifically about fixing your eyes upon Jesus and inserting the flag instead. It's blasphemy. That is, theologically, that's what that is. And so since I figured out last week how to bleep things, I'm pretty comfortable saying that the Christianity of the Republican Party is utter horseshit. And it's not Christianity.
Right.
So
it's a death cult.
It is that. And this is the thing. Let me really be clear. Like, I'm not that anyone really cares one way or the other. I'm not a Democrat either. I'm not I frankly think that people who identify themselves as Christian should find it between difficult and impossible, even in the best of circumstances, to wholly identify themselves with any political party.
Right, or really any nationalist sort of loyalties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The American, although that's true. Yeah, I almost forgot to rant about the American exceptionalism stuff. Yeah. The idea that America is the city set on a hill. I'll tell you what, if you're listening and you believe that, feel free to reach out to me. I will be glad to have a Bible study with you. And I'm being completely serious here, okay? I probably sound strident as all get out now, but I'm completely serious. The idea that America is God's chosen people is unsustainable biblically. And so if you want to show me where you think that is and you want to talk about that, I'll be glad to have that conversation with anybody. It's not there. And we are, selling that is again where you get closer and closer to these very dangerous kind of regimes, where you're cutting yourself off not only from, because this is the thing, but by saying that, by arguing that we're the party that believes that America is exceptional, that America is this set apart by God special place, not only are you cutting off the rest of the world, which is a profoundly un-Christian behavior, but you are now demonizing the other party, because if the other party doesn't agree with you, then they are the tool of Satan. They are, and now you're inviting like holy war inside of our country.
Yeah, we're pretty far along in terms of that.
That's demonic. And again, if anyone wants to do a Bible study with me on that, I'll be glad to.
I'm leaving some space for that to breathe. So what is your thought?
Yeah.
Then, as long as we've...
As long as we're on this heavy road? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess there's two elements to this. Just the very idea of having moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
The U.S. Embassy in Israel, Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And then, while it had been fairly transparent, I think, the whole time, very recently saying, the president saying that was done specifically for the evangelicals. What do you think of that?
Which part of that? The pandering to evangelicals or the actual act of moving the embassy and...
Address whatever part of it you want.
Okay.
I mean, the pandering part is probably the more obvious part, too.
Yeah, the pandering to evangelicals is disgusting, and evangelicals should and should always have seen that as a trap. Any Christians, because again, read your damn Bible. The Bible never says that the end game is that we get to side with the leaders. The Bible never says that. You know what Jesus is really about is finding the right political party and getting really cozy with them. So, I mean, that's insane. So the fact that evangelicals, you know, got sweet talked on that one. Again, there have been times that more liberal denominations got sweet talked by the Democratic Party. But at this moment, where what's really dangerous is evangelicals, who have let the Republicans put their hand up their shirt, and it's gross. And here's where it really makes me mad. Is that all of this stuff, all of this, the pro-Israel stuff and all this, it's all built on dispensationalist theology, which again is completely garbage theology.
Well, it's anti-Semitic theology, really.
Well, it's anti-Semitic, yes, but I'm just saying that dispensationalism is a garbage fire of a theological system, okay? That's what I'm saying.
And you know your dispensationalism, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You were trained to understand
this is probably going to mean that I'm out for Moody Alumni of the Year for 2020, but there it is. Yeah, it's bad theology. It's real bad theology. It's not understanding the book of Revelation at all. And it all flows out of that. It all comes back to, you know, doing stuff that's fear-based and trying to reassure ourselves that there's something that we can do, that in the end, the power is going to be with us.
Well, it's about winning again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know where winning is. Christianity and winning are.
No. The book of Revelation tells us that Jesus, that the kingdom of God wins. It doesn't say that Christians win. It doesn't say Americans win. It doesn't say American Christians win. It doesn't say evangelicals win. It doesn't say any of those people win. It says ultimately the kingdom reigns.
Right.
And so maybe this is another thing for us to keep in mind. Because I, you know, as incensed as we are, as I am, about all of this, I think it's important to keep in mind that I think, again, if you're going to read the book of Revelation, and I think you should, I actually think that if you take the time to really get careful with the book of Revelation, that it's a super important book for Christians living this far after the earthly ministry of Jesus. If you're going to actually read it and take it seriously and try to understand it on its terms instead of your terms, part of what you're going to end up understanding is that things will get bad. And things will get worse. And every time you think things are as bad as they could get, They haven't gotten as bad as they could get. Okay. Now that's not saying that that means that history is this long perpetual slide to death, which is what that's the triumphalist theology of dispensationalism that says everything's going to continue to get worse, and then we rise, right? What Revelation is really talking about is that the power of the state, the power of powers and principalities to harm people and to be against the kingdom of God is limitless. It will always happen. And every time you think you've solved it, it will crop up in a new way. And you will think that what you're looking at is the person who just helped you solve it. And unfortunately, sometimes that is the person who will help usher in the new way that it's going to be a train wreck and a disaster. But in the end, what is important is that the kingdom of God wins. That's the only winning that matters.
Wins in the sense that it is what remains.
It is what remains.
Not winning in a traditional sense as though... Well, I guess there
well, it talks about element. Putting down its enemies, right? But I think, again, even
but
there...
But enemies is also a pretty fixed point, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, I think... And again, I've got to be careful because I'm not an actual scholar or anything. But the enemies of God are those who oppose God's purposes. That's what it means to be an enemy. Not to be in the wrong party in the wrong time. And so...
Right, so from a Socratic standpoint, then the next question is, what are God's purposes? This is turning into a different kind of podcast right now, but I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Because I think these end up being questions that people have. I think people who did not grow up in the church like we did, mm-hmm. who did not have, to varying degrees, types of Bible school education and that sort of thing, none of this makes any sense, right?
Right.
Like, where is this even coming from? What is the goal here? Why are there Christians thinking this way? Because this isn't necessarily how Christians thought 30 years ago.
Well, Christians have been thinking this way a lot for the last, again, dispensationalism has been around for a couple hundred years, which would be another thing to keep in mind. Again, if you're unaware of this, if this is not clear to you, this whole line of interpretation is less than 200 or 250 years old. It's very, very new. So out of 2,000 years of interpreting scripture and reading scripture, it's a blip. It just showed up.
There was a point in the lifetime of many people now when going to church was not a political action.
Right.
Right, there was not a direct political affiliation that was almost assumed.
Yeah.
If you were going to be a part of a church.
Yeah.
And that's been that kind of melding of bad theology and win at all costs, and it's a mulligatawny of I don't even know what, but this idea that because I think there's also a big difference between what then the Book of Revelation would be alluding to in terms of what is the purpose of the kingdom of God.
Right.
And what perhaps people are thinking right now.
Mm-hmm. So like, and again, I'll just pull a couple of things very quickly to try to answer that, like you said, that Socratic question. So what are God's purposes? Well, in the book of Luke, chapter 19, verse 10, Jesus is recorded as saying that the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Okay, so pretty consistently, what I think you can see, that's just one example, but you can look through Scripture and you can find that there is a reclaiming, there is a restoration of that which has been separated, whether you look at that or whether you look at the parable of the prodigal, whether you look, I mean, you go over and over, you look all through Jesus talking about what he was doing. He was there to bring people into right relationship with God.
And the idea of what was right relationship with God was, I think, fairly simply defined biblically, right?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are some very, very simple statements, you know, it could be as simple as saying that, you know, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, and all of your mind, and all of your soul, and all of your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, I could, you know, some people will say it boils down to, it's that simple, that's what God desires from people.
Well, there's ways certainly in which that then becomes fleshed out in terms of what your action is. But that's, I mean, it's probably is the simplest, you know, the distillation of kind of what you're going to look like, mm-hmm. or what your goals are going to be, where your heart is going to be pointed if you are a follower of Jesus, right?
Yeah. I think so. Well, and again, the other thing that you might say, I'm very partial to the writings that are attributed to John, within the New Testament, the Gospel of John, 1st and 2nd and 3rd John, and Revelation. Those are books that I come back to over and over again, and within the Gospel of John, near the end, John is kind of starting to wrap things up, and there is this really amazing statement at the end of chapter 20. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written. I wrote what I wrote. These are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, or the chosen one, the Son of God, the Messiah, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So if we want to ask the other question, what are God's intentions? What are God's desires? What is it that God is seeking to accomplish in the flowering of his kingdom? It's that the creation would have life. So, again, I mean, you know, that just takes you down pathways like, I'll be lost if I go much further, but to say that, I mean, if we say that, that's, I think that is a central impulse, is that that God seeks to restore those who have lost relationship with God, those who are not in communion with God, those desires that the creation would live and flourish abundantly.
And see, it's very God-centered. Mm-hmm. It's not that people would believe certain things and you know, help to conform their neighbor's behavior to that. It is the prime directive is resuming communion with God.
Yeah.
Now there are going to be parts of that based upon, you know, knowledge that has been passed down that will dictate what behavior is,
mm-hmm.
right? But what struck me, and I'm obviously a great deal more of a skeptic now than you are, a lot of theology is speculative, because you don't necessarily read the Bible and get a lot of, it's not like a theological lesson.
Right.
On a regular basis. And in areas where there is theology being imparted, you know, understanding of God, it's not like there are hundreds of pages devoted to ideas or anything.
Right.
We're taking ideas that are put forth often in seed form, and there are people that have then speculated based upon the sum of what our teachings and understandings are, what that means and how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think most of the places where there is, again, I think we in the modern world undervalue story. I think mm-hmm. that's story is making a huge revival in this generation, but people that are in power still, I think, undervalue story and miss the fact that within the Hebrew scriptures and the Greek scriptures, a lot of the places that like truth is being communicated, it's being communicated in story, and it's being communicated by telling a story that posits this is who God is, as opposed to who other people are telling you God is, or other nations are telling you that their gods are, or you know,
Hello. So I can't lean that far back, or else the microphone will fall off.
That is a bummer.
My apologies.
That's all right. That was a bracing wake up call. So, but that's so. I think we have tended to look for like propositional truths, and miss the fact that a lot of times what the Bible is doing, a lot of what Jesus said. I mean, again, early chapters of like Genesis that literalists try to read for science facts. They miss the fact that that this is poetry that is telling a story, and it's telling a story about one way of looking at God that is contrary to the ways that some other cultures around the people of Israel were describing and defining the divine. Okay? And then Jesus is coming and is telling stories, and he's telling stories that are saying this is, again, like you can take like the story of the Good Samaritan, right? How it subverts the idea that the people who thought they were the good guys ultimately had to see themselves in that story as the people who would walk past the man who had been the victim of this robbery and beating. And the person that they would think of as human garbage was the person who actually risked and gave sacrificially to save that person. And so Jesus is pushing through these stories to say, this is an image of who God is or what God is doing, and the way that is different from what you think. And again, I think the fact that the generations that are growing up right now are much more imbued with story than like our generation was and the generation before us can be a good thing if we let it be. So
how do we extricate ourselves from this?
Well, we put a lot of meat out there to chew on.
I have many more leading. Did I get cut off again?
No.
Okay. I have many more leading questions that I, you know, theoretically, that, you know, that I have in my mind, but this isn't a 12-part series. So.
Well, let's try to leave it there for now then. I mean, I think that it's, we got down this path because we're saying this is a really fraught time. And it is. And I think that I find it sad because I think that, like I said, the people that I have identified myself with throughout my life, which is the Christian church, I think a lot of the Christian church has done an enormous amount of damage to the image of God in recent years in America. And I think that's heartbreaking. And I think that it continues to try to align itself with power and purposes of power for security and for just lust of power, frankly. And I can tell you this, that doesn't end well. That I'm pretty confident in saying out of the book of Revelation. That does not end well. So.
Yeah, I'm struck by the inflexibility of thought. In situations where thought needs to be flexible. Mm-hmm. I think that how the Christian or person of faith interacts with the world around them, that there needs to be flexibility in their thought there based upon what I think should be the purpose of the church. Because rigidity is not going to allow you to create an opening with someone else.
No.
To understand and to where they're thinking and what their needs are, and to understand how what you offer them helps them. You know, it's not just I have a square peg and it's going to fit into everything. It's about helping people understand how your square peg helps them. And that doesn't just apply to religion. It applies to any line of thought or service. And I think in politics there needs to be less rigidity of thought.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're not a society that where everyone is of the same mind. There has to end up being some compromise. There has to be a way to find how this works for everyone. And maybe that doesn't really ever happen, but it has to happen better than it's happening right now.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think you could say that the more there is that rigidity of thought, the less flexible people are able to be in a political process like ours, the more it raises the likelihood of catastrophic ends, right?
Right. That it'll all break.
Yeah. Well.
All right, well, that's...
That's not the happiest ending place, but welcome to 2020, right?
I think we're going to name this episode, like, Puppies and Bunnies or something.
Oh, jeez, yeah. I'm going
to trick people into listening to this.
Well, let's be at least... Are we sending people to the... Have we changed our mailing address again? Or are we going to leave it the same for a week?
I think it's so far so good.
It's stable there. Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where is that again?
That's Calhoun, Colorado.
Calhoun, Colorado. That's right.
Right. Right. I have... there's a municipality I had spoken with some people, or at least made some contact.
Yeah.
And that contact continues, but we'll see.
Okay.
So far, so good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Let's hope this doesn't break.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I haven't had it, because I haven't had a chance to fly into the Calhoun International Airport yet to check things out.
I don't even think they bill it as an international
airport. And meet with the mayor and to handle the hostile takeover of the Woolsey Finer Foods. So, we'll take care of that. If you don't know what we're talking about right now, that means you didn't make it through the 2-hour episode that we put out last time. So, sorry. Anyway. Yeah, look for us on Facebook. We're on Sons of the Double Cheeseburger, if you want to tell us anything. And again, I may have sounded really pissed off when I said I'll do a Bible study with anybody, but that wasn't a threat. That was sincere. If you're like, I want to actually understand where this is coming from or what's happening there, or I want to discuss that topic, I will discuss with you. So please reach out to me there, or reach out to me by sending to my email address, brandon.woosley@gmail.com. I'll talk to you. So, I don't have all the answers, but I'll talk. And I'll listen.
That's fair, I think.
Yeah. So, Kevin, until next time, stay safe. Continue to maintain some distance.
You too.
Wear a mask, people. Seriously. What is your team's name, by the way?
The team Shore Glass.
Shore Glass.
It's our sponsor, yeah.
Nice.
Which there's a lost opportunity because the shop is actually called the Glasshopper Shore Glass.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Glasshopper would be an awesome name.
It sure would be.
But no, we're Shore Glass.
Do your fans call themselves Glassholes?
No.
Okay. Just checking.
That's Glassinine, all right?
That is Glassinine.
No, well, they've been a sponsor for a long time, and they're fine people.
Nice.
It's, you know, more. If I were making the decisions, I would. Cause I think there's a little fun to go fun there, but it's fine. We're proud to represent Shore Glass.
Well, in your next game, may it be Glass-tastic, and we're rooting for them. That team, what do we call them? We call them the Shore Glass Nine? What do we call them?
There's the 12 of us right now, but yeah.
All right. But there's only 9 on the field at one time, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we call you the Shore Glass Nine.
Right.
And that's the official baseball team.
There's only 9 on the field at any one time, and then there's 3 asking why they're having to sit.
That's right.
And saying, can I play shortstop next inning?
Yes.
Hey, can I pitch this next inning?
That's correct.
Have you ever pitched before? No. Can I pitch this next inning? Well, it is a playoff game. We're probably not going to throw you out
there. Maybe not at this point in the season.
Right.
This is less of the development time and more of the performance time. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that game. We'll
thank you.
Have to talk about how that finished up the next time. And we'll see what kind of hate mail we got from this. Probably not Jim Gaffigan levels of hate mail, but...
That's all right.
Yeah.
I'll take whatever hate mail there is.
Yeah.
And I'll take the positive mail too, obviously.
And I got to be honest, I don't mean to like toot my own horn here or brag, but I do think that we were way ahead of Jim Gaffigan on this, cuz years ago my attitude was Holtz. And I think yours was too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's never been anything other than that.
I mean, I'm glad that Jim finally came around. But yeah, welcome to the tribe, Jim. And if you want to come on this podcast, Jim Gaffigan, you're welcome.
We'll even pronounce your name correctly.
We will. I always put that invitation out to the celebs, and Jim Gaffigan, you would be an honored guest, indeed. All right, so listen to future episodes, folks, because probably Jim Gaffigan's going to be on them.
Right, Jim Gaffigan and Lou Holtz will be debating each other.
They will, yes. And we're going to have Paul F. Tompkins moderate that.
I think that's where we need to get Judge John Hodgman involved.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're right. He really would be the better moderator. That's a good point. All right, John Hodgman, check your schedule. We're going to check with Lou and Jim.
It's all coming together pretty quickly.
It's all coming together fast.
So, everyone, be ready.
Yeah.
All right.
Life comes at you fast in 2020.
Well, I'm looking forward to this now. I mean, there was a point where I was kind of like, where is this thing really going? But now I feel like there's some purpose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now that we know we're going to be addressing such heavy topics with such renowned public figures.
Indeed. And Lou Holtz.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Sorry, that was my way of saying I don't hold Lou Holtz in renown.
I'm not going to cast, you know, throw shade on Lou Holtz. I had many different ways. I was trying to think of the right way to do it, the best one. But I decided I'm not going to.
Fair
simply
enough.
Because I don't know that it's necessary.
No, I think he's got enough dirt on him right now. All right. Well, until next time, Kevin, good talking to you.
Yeah. See you later.
See you later.
Oh, bye-bye.
Bye.